Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people who do fine art with needle and thread. And this week, we are doing the finest of fine art with needle and thread. We have with us Margaret Lee to talk about Japanese and Chinese embroidery. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you, Gary.
Oh, so excited to do this because this is a fascinating world to me, this Chinese and Japanese embroidery. Now, just a bunch of dumb guy questions for the next hour, just because we need to learn about these things. And this is, this is just obviously for anyone who even has half a clue, ancient art with needle and thread that I think a lot of people just don't know about. So I'm going to just ask a bunch of questions and let you educate us. And now all right. the first dumb guy question is Chinese and Japanese embroidery. Now, I've studied quite a bit here just getting ready for this, and there are distinct differences, but it's hard for me to define them. Now, is Chinese your original embroidery technique, or Japanese, or how have you approached this?
I'm going to answer this with maybe an explanation about Chinese and Japanese embroidery and its origin.
Okay, I'll take that. Excellent.
Okay. Now, Chinese embroidery has a tradition of almost 5,000 years. It started from body tattoo techniques, and that's how embroidery started. And when people started a weaving process and they started covering their bodies, and that's when, instead of tattooing the body, they started putting embroidery onto the fabric. Now, in our embroidery, as it has developed, it started off as embroidery more for practical decoration of clothing, and eventually it moved into decoration of small personal items. And then subsequently, it actually transformed over the years, and there's quite an interesting transformation with Chinese embroidery, that it transformed itself from a very practical art, decorating very practical items into fine art. And from that transformation, embroidery itself branched out into three different directions. One, it was the practical embroidery. And then we have another category called banner embroidery. And then we have art embroidery. And Japanese embroidery actually came from the practical and banner embroidery side of things. And so that's where the division occurred. And Japanese embroidery actually had its roots from Chinese embroidery.
Okay, Margaret, I'm gonna interrupt you right here. So let me go back all the way to the beginning. So tattooing is really the origin of this?
Yes.
Oh.
That's what it was believed to be.
Okay. So what, did they go to embroidery because they ran out of skin to tattoo?
Well, I think they started settling, and from a nomadic lifestyle, they settled into a settlement, and then weaving started, and once weaving started, clothing came into being, and decoration of the clothing then came about.
Okay. All right. That's just interesting because basically the tattoo is the original art form for this. That's interesting.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So sorry, I had to get that straight in my head. So then we move on to Japanese. That evolves out of Chinese.
Yes. And it actually came to Japan through Buddhism, through religion.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Hmm. But now there's distinct differences, right?
There are. One is more practical, and because it is for practical and decorative purposes, the designs in themselves are more stylized in nature. And of course, once the Japanese culture took over, it actually developed into its own unique identity. But you can still see that some of the stitches and the techniques involved are based on the Chinese tradition.
Okay. Now, let's go back, because in my studies here, to try and determine what the differences was, yes, I detected more stylized with the Japanese, and Chinese is almost the equivalent of creating portraits of developing, doing needlework that really you can't tell if it's a picture from a camera or needle and thread or just or a painting or whatever. Is that correct? Is that really where we can break them apart?
No, I think if you look at if you look at the comparison between art embroidery and Japanese embroidery, yes, there is a fair distinction there. But if you look at the practical and banner embroidery category of Chinese embroidery, there's a lot of overlap.
Oh, okay.
Actually, except for a few techniques, you can see that most of them are quite similar, and you can actually see the roots from where it developed. The silk that we use are the same. However, there is a little bit of difference in that the silk that we use in Chinese embroidery are thrown, that we call it throwing the silk, are thrown a little bit more softer than the Japanese silk. Mm. And because of that, for our art embroidery, we can actually split our silk down to very, very much finer filaments than we can with the Japanese embroidery silk.
Oh, okay.
But they're both the same silk, and it's just the way that it is processed and thrown is a little bit different.
Now, you guys get pretty specific about where the silk comes from. What silkworms, is that correct?
That's correct, and it's from a species called the Bombyx mori. Again, originated from China, but unfortunately, it no longer exists in the wild. It's all cultivated now.
Oh.
It is actually a flightless moth.
And you know, that part just is amazing to me. What is it about that silk that it gets used? Is it a strength? Is it a sheen? What is it about that silk that makes it the choice?
It is the sheen. Silk is actually a protein. So unlike your cotton and wool and and threads that are made from cellular in nature, silk is actually a protein. And because it is a protein, it does not absorb light. It actually reflects light.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use that quality of its reflection to produce the movement, we call it, through the techniques that we apply to our embroidery.
Okay.
And that you can get it all very lifelike.
Okay, now it makes sense to me. All right. So let's take Chinese first. Now, I know that Japanese, because I have a minimal exposure to it, have 10 phases as you develop the techniques. Does the Chinese embroidery have a similar approach? How is it that you, if you start to learn Chinese embroidery, how is it that you progress to become a master, if I can use that word?
Okay, we would have, again, similar to the Japanese embroidery, we are very much technique-based. The 10 phases that we learn in Japanese embroidery is actually developed by the school that we are attached to, which is a Japanese embroidery center in Atlanta, with its head office back in Japan, in Chiba City. And they have chosen to divide their learning of the 46 techniques of Japanese embroidery into 10 phases. The way that I have actually developed my course is that I have done it so that it is at a foundation level. And the foundation level incorporates about 20 different techniques. Each of them has got its own characteristics in which we learn to apply in various different situations. And then we move on to the intermediate level, in which we then introduce another category of stitching technique called random stitch embroidery. And then from there, we move into the advanced level.
Okay, is that for Japanese or for Chinese?
That's for Chinese. I've divided it into three levels.
Okay. So So three levels, and within that are several techniques within each level.
We have over 40 techniques as well within our art embroidery. The reason why I have chosen not to have it at face level is because Japanese embroidery being stylized in nature for the design, a lot of the application of the techniques are very prescriptive, whereas with Chinese art embroidery, not only is there a prescriptive nature to the techniques, but there is also an interpretative side when it comes to application, which adds another layer of complexity to the practice of the art.
And all of this is very precise and demanding in terms of perfection of the technique. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So if I'm going to be learn to do Chinese embroidery, lots of years and hours and hours and hours of practice to get very, very exact in my technique.
I would say yes, you do need to put in the practice, but if you are guided by a good practitioner, you will gain a level fairly quickly.
Okay. Now, help me with the three types of Chinese embroidery. Do we start at the beginning when I first start to learn these things? Does it not matter and then we branch out later, or do I tend to choose one technique and learn that, if that makes
No,
sense?
right. I think the first thing is to choose whether you want to do what you wish to learn. I would say that my preferred focus is on art embroidery. Because practical embroidery is probably in today's modern world not so sought after. And even within the Chinese home concept, I think it's not as applicable as it used to be. And so the art embroidery is the way forward. To me, it's a lot more challenging as well.
Okay, so all right, so that's all right, that's where I want to go, where the challenge is at. So that's the art, okay? 'Cause the
And
other
I would say,
the practical, that's where we get into those I want to call them patches, but the different levels, patches that for military status, is that where the practical comes in?
that's the practical, yes.
Okay. And that's pretty straightforward then.
Yep. If I might just maybe give a little bit of a history as to the development of art embroidery from the practical side.
Yes.
So it started, as I said, with decoration of apparels and personal items and items for home decoration. And then when Buddhism was introduced, and they started then the embroidery of artifacts for religion came into being. And the first embroidery for appreciation, as we call it, was actually embroidery of a bodhisattva related to the Buddhist religion. So it was purely done for embroidery, and it was done with a message. And it also appealed to the senses for the first time because it was used for religious purposes as opposed to practical purposes. And then from there, it went from embroidery for appreciation and then into the Song Dynasty. It started to gain a level that developed at the same time as art, as Chinese painting. And then it became a category that was known as embroidered paintings, taking after all the equivalent of Chinese brush painting of landscape as well as flower and birds and basically nature, flora and fauna as well. And it became accepted then at that time as an art in itself. And then from there into the Ming Dynasty, which is about 400 years ago, it became accepted by the literati of the period as embroidery being one of the collector's item for a true connoisseur of art. And from there, it developed further and became what we call a embroidery in the reality. And that was when shadow, light and shadow of the art world was incorporated into the embroidery. And subsequent to that, there was another layer of category of techniques that was introduced, which is what we call random stitch embroidery. And it is something that was able to allow us in our techniques combined together to emulate Western art or oil painting.
Okay.
And from there it became true art.
So this is interesting to me in that here in the States and definitely in Europe, is ongoing debate about whether needle art is art or craft. And we've had that discussion with more than one person. Jessica Grimm is one in Germany about whether and trying to get classified as an artist. And then so from the Chinese-Japanese perspective, there's no question it's art.
Well, from the Chinese perspective, definitely it is art, because even a few hundred years ago, back in the Ming Dynasty, it was already considered art.
Okay.
And the way that we approach our embroidery is art. And I have a good description of that in my first book, The Art of Chinese Embroidery, The Foundation Level. And I talked a lot about, you know, that to be a true practitioner of the art, one of the first things that you have to do when you approach it is that you have to look on it as art. Otherwise, you're just going to stymie yourself and not be able to move forward in the practice of it.
Yes.
So when you approach it, the way we analyze it, the way we select a technique, the thickness of thread, the colors, it is all in that holistic approach that you would with art.
Okay. All right. Now I want to learn about the technique, but let's get the explanation for the Japanese on the record here. And then I want to go back and talk about the techniques. So the Japanese thing is fascinating to me. In what we have, was it 10 distinct phases? But then it's so strange to me that we have a school in Atlanta. Is that the center these days, or is there still a center for this art in Japan and the one in Atlanta is kind of an offshoot? I don't understand that one.
All right. What happened was Master Iwai Saito, who founded Kuranakai in Japan, that's the parent company, he had this vision of bringing Japanese embroidery outside Japan. And his vision was that if he brought it outside of Japan, it will actually help to promote the art, which, you know, over time was dying a bit. So that was his vision. And so he set up the Japanese Embroidery Center in Atlanta to promote Japanese embroidery to the world, to the Western world outside Japan.
Okay. But still retaining a center in Japan.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I would hate to see it not be centered in Japan. So there's two centers, one for the Western world and then one in Japan.
Yes, but they do work cooperatively.
Yes.
So say, for example, next year, Japanese Embroidery Center is actually organizing a class in Japan for those practitioners who are from outside Japan to have a class as well as to visit an exhibition there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ooh. I thought everything had moved to Atlanta, and I was nervous about that.
In fact, one of the advanced classes is going to be conducted by their head professional in the workshop, Mr. Yamashita.
Okay. And then describe to me the 10 phases. It's not unlike the Chinese then, but 10 distinct phases that you must go through to achieve the top level.
I would not say the top level. I would say that the 10 phases teaches you the practice of all the techniques.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and in each of the phases, you will actually focus on the understanding of a technique and its application to that particular project that you're working on in that phase.
Okay, so it doesn't build on itself. I see, I thought it built on itself and you progress through to some kind of a master level, but it's 10 distinct techniques, and then the mastery comes from learning all of those well.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay.
And in the last phase, in phase 10, it's actually a consolidation phase in which you will work through a project that contains basically all the techniques in that one project.
Okay.
And then beyond that, we actually have phases that go up to phase 20. And in each of them,
Excellent.
in each of those phases, what happens is that you apply the knowledge of the techniques that you have gained, but the application is at a much higher and more sophisticated level to achieve the movement and to also achieve the visual effects that one would hope for in the particular design.
Okay. Now, is there, as you go through this, is design integrated into the process, or as with other needle art techniques, do we have designers and then people who execute? Or is design just an integral part? How does that fit in?
Generally, with the Japanese embroidery, there are specialist designers
Okay.
who design, and then they have the practitioners that practice. It's a little bit different on the Chinese embroidery side, in which we actually look at a design, and it is then up to the practitioner. Very often, the practitioner is also the designer. But in the old days, we have, this is dating well back, about maybe 700 years ago, we actually have things of instructions from the books of rites, which says that the painter and the embroiderer must work together. So there are edicts like that
Oh,
well
my.
back. Yes. And so painting and embroidery has always worked hand in hand. And as you go down through history, there are a lot of embroiderers who are also painters themselves, and so therefore they paint their own design.
Boy, that's a powerful set of talents to be able to paint and embroider at that level.
It is, especially during the Tang Dynasty. That was when women were taught more scholarly things like poetry, painting, and that was when embroidery went up a really big step into the art world.
And for the Japanese, there's also almost a spiritual component to the needlework. Is that correct? I mean, that fits into it, plays into it, is from what I understand.
That is very much correct, because when you sit down to stitch, you get into a zone.
Yeah.
And old Master Saito used to say that the hands are the exit of our spirit.
Okay. So it really, it's a mental state that you try to achieve while you're stitching.
It is. And I think it all stems again from the Buddhist religion. Because in Chinese embroidery, during that period when Buddhism was introduced, the act of embroidery itself was seen as an act of worship.
Okay.
And so it became a practice that it was not only an act of worship, it was also a meditation as you embroider, images of bodhisattvas or Sanskrit and things like that, or religious texts.
So then that spiritual component is as big a role in Chinese embroidery as it is in Japanese, then. It's all tied together.
I would not say it is as deep as that, but certainly once you get into the practice of it, you do get into a kind of like a spiritual zone, a calmness, a peace with and the peace that you feel with that needle in your hand.
And when you do classes, do you try to achieve an atmosphere that promotes that, or are classes purely a learning thing?
Well, I think naturally the class becomes very quiet because everybody is concentrating on what they're doing. So we do have our moments of laughter and fun, but once everyone gets serious on what they're doing, generally the quiet just comes automatically.
Okay, so they just all right. This is I love this. I love this stuff where there's that extra component to it. Because I think in just anyone who does needlework over time will have periods, certainly periods and maybe even extended ones, where they just enter another world and are able to just remove themselves from the everyday things, and it just becomes a complete escape. And when you bring in a spiritual aspect to it, that really adds a new dimension. That's great.
That is a really that's one of the biggest appeal of embroidery.
And then now for you, Chinese was your first technique?
Yes, I learned it in the traditional way, from mother to daughter.
Ah, okay.
Right. Because in the Chinese tradition, teaching the mother teaching a daughter embroidery is more than teaching embroidery. It is teaching the daughter a whole lot more. It teaches the daughter dedication, patience, organization, a contribution to the family and the country in that in the imperial period, because embroidery and silk itself is a store of value and a medium of exchange. So, and one of the things is that matchmaking was rife in those days, and couples get married without seeing each other, and daughter-in-laws are selected purely very often on the level and of their embroidery skills, because in being able to do good embroidery, it means that you have been properly schooled with patience, diligence, organization, all the qualities that will make you a good wife.
All demonstrated through a piece of thread. Excellent. So how early did your mother start teaching you? Very early?
I cannot put a direct age to it, but I would say that I would probably be around 8 or 9. And we all started with practical embroidery and stitching household items like pillowcases, bed sheets, curtains, cushions. Yep, so that's what we start with, practical embroidery, and then we progress on to the art embroidery.
You obviously have continued this through your whole life. Does that happen with most girls at that age? Do they continue, or is it, does it kind of select itself out and girls move on to other things because they're just not interested in embroidery?
I think in the modern day, definitely that is the case, but I've always loved embroidery and doing things with my hands.
In the older day, that was the means of contributing to the family, so girls stuck with it.
Yes, and it's not just contributing to the contributing to the family's finances, but it also helps beautify the home, clothe the family, So there's a whole lot of it involved. And one of the key things is that in just in the teaching of the embroidery, this is more than there is also that spiritual aspect of bonding of the parent and the daughters and within the family. And yeah, so it always falls on the old elder in the family, elder women in the family, to pass on those skills to the younger ones.
Yes. And so for you, it just became a love, though you had a regular business career,
Yes, I do.
but the embroidery just continued on as a more of a hobby or twin careers.
It was actually my outlet because the career I was in was fairly stressful at times, and so for me the embroidery was something to take that away, take me away into that zone that we talk about.
I think we all use it for that. Yes.
That's right.
Yes. So then you left the business world and decided to spend your entire time teaching and developing.
No, I think I was an accidental teacher.
Oh, okay.
Very much so. Things just happened. One thing led to another, and it was never in my plan. And it's here we are, and things just fall along the way. And I was asked to write a book, and so okay, I wrote a book on Chinese embroidery. Then I wrote a beading book. I have a second book on Chinese embroidery, the intermediate level, focusing on random stitch embroidery. That's in production at the moment and expected to be released early next year. And then I have also been asked to contribute to the Routledge Encyclopedia on traditional Chinese embroidery. So the chapter on embroidery is written by me, and that's going to be released at the end of this year. So if you want to know a little bit more about the transition of Chinese embroidery from practical embroidery and its role in and importance in Chinese culture, look it up in the Routledge Encyclopedia when it comes out.
Boy, you are busy. Right?
Well, it was great fun, and I think it is something that is not very well understood because embroidery in the Chinese culture is not just embroidery. It had a role in government, in politics, in the family, in finances, in the economics of country, and it has a very deep role within the whole societal culture of the whole dynasties, imperial dynasties, even through modern China, and until today, it is still has a very important role.
Now, how is it that you come to do Japanese? Is that just something that you wanted to learn in addition?
Well, Japanese embroidery caught my eye, and I thought, that's interesting. I went and found out a little bit more about it, and I saw the parallel that of Chinese art, practical embroidery that it came from. And I said, I'd like to learn a little bit more about it. And so there we are. One thing led to another.
But still, your orientation and your base and your origin and love is Chinese embroidery.
Well, I like Japanese embroidery as well. They're both to me.
Okay.
To me, they're very similar because our practical embroidery, gave root to Japanese embroidery. So I have an instant affiliation with it.
Right. And then the bead thing, you mentioned the bead, Japanese bead embroidery. That's impressive stuff. Now, and you have a book on that. How does that come into play in your needlework career?
Well, the bead embroidery was actually a companion art to traditional Japanese embroidery, and its techniques was based on the techniques of Japanese embroidery, and it was actually developed by Iwao Saito from the school in Japan, and so it's quite unique to Kuranakai and as well as the Japanese Embroidery Center. For me, it was some bling adding to my life, and that was what attracted me here in the first place. And subsequent to learning it, I was given the chance to study under Master Matsukawa-san in Beijing. And she was the person who was, together with Master Iwai Saito, developed the art. So I studied under her for a few years in Japan. And there we are. I have this deep urge always that when I learn something, I have to find out all about it. And so when Matsukawa-san retired, she has only had one book written, and that's in Japanese. So when she retired, I felt that maybe it is time to have one book out in English. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, and that is my respect to her and my way of honoring her.
Yeah, I get the sense that you don't do anything halfway. You got to go all the way with these things. I picked up on that.
That's right. That's right.
Now is
and I think that's the only way. That's the only way to become really good in anything. I think we need to put it the focus and to understand it. And if you understand it, you are then able to apply it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I try to instill that in all my students. And I'm very proud with some of the things that they achieve. So in my next book that's coming out next year, you will see quite a few of my students work in it.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's fantastic. Great.
I think those who see it will be very impressed, because most of these ladies have studied with me for a fairly short time. Yeah.
Oh, that's great that they get to it. Yeah, well, number one, that they're good enough to be in a book, but also just that that kind of a thing, to work so hard and then have their work included in something like that. That's terrific.
Yeah, I think I'm very proud of what they have achieved. So
is beading, is that also a very precise stage phase level process?
It is, because we have five phases in beading, and to get a good result, you have to be precise. And I think with the Japanese, as you know, everything is about precision.
Yeah, well, the pieces on your website, the little clutches and handbags, there's clearly a high level of precision in the way those beads are placed and held in. And that's in itself has got to be quite a technique.
It is. And even the way you stitch it, the direction of your stitch is very important and plays a role in getting the effect that we want.
So when you teach, I'm interested in the teaching too. You teach locally, but then also do classes internationally. Is most of your teaching in Australia?
No, I have classes in Australia. I go to Europe once a year. I used to go twice a year, but I've now cut it down to once a year, but staying for longer period. So that's in November every year. I'm in Europe, and I have students from over Europe and from the US as well that comes to France. That's where I'm based for our classes there. And I teach in New Zealand and Australia.
Okay.
That takes up my year.
Yeah. And in Australia there, you're in Adelaide. I forgot to mention that. Regular weekly classes?
No, I actually have classes in not weekly classes. I have class blocks of 6 days, and I have them in Brisbane, in Melbourne, in Sydney, in Perth, Adelaide, of course. And I also teach sometimes for conventions, like Inspirations Conventions, that is held twice a year.
Well, you travel a lot.
Yeah.
I noticed that you're in France in November when it's blazing hot in Australia. Good move.
That's correct. It's my chance to escape the heat.
Well played. Excellent. So talk to me about the technique. You use with all of them on a slate frame. What talk about the tools and techniques.
Right. Generally, the frames that we use have to be a frame that stretches the fabric all four ways, and it also allows us to make minute adjustment, because the the texture and the fabric itself has to be held taut, and it's got to be held in such a way that we can make adjustments so that it is suitable for the embroidery that we're doing. So sometimes, for example, like in the Japanese embroidery, we use a traditional Japanese frame, which also allows us to stretch the fabric all four ways. Say, for example, we're doing the fuzzy technique. The fabric cannot be held as tightly as if we were doing gold work. That then allows us to adjust the framing up of our fabric to the exact precision that we require for the technique that we want to apply.
Through the course of a project, then the tension on the ground cloth is adjusted up and down according to what the technique you're using at the moment.
That's correct. Yes.
Magnifier and light, or do you do it just with your eyes?
I try to discourage the use of magnifiers because of the exacting nature of the embroidery. So obviously, with age, our eyes do change, but I have my glasses done by my optometrist so that it is work to the distance of my sewing.
Okay. So then, yes.
And
Okay.
that.
So I can, so you can just basically, it's just your eyes helped with your glasses rather than looking through a magnifier.
That's correct. And we prefer natural light, so morning light. So certain things that are more intricate, I will do in the morning light, as opposed to doing it under artificial light in the evening. Selecting thread colors is definitely a morning job. 10 o'clock is the best because the 10 o'clock light is the most natural light. By afternoon, you get the light tends to turn into a more yellow light, so sometimes it can affect how we see colors in our threads. We are very pedantic, if nothing else.
Yes. So, and then the silk, how is that acquired? I mean, we get skeins of cotton floss and all those things. Do we buy silk the same way for this kind of thing? Are the strands very fine? Depends on the technique. How does the thread come in? How does that work?
The thread, the one for Japanese is comes in strands. When I say strand, it comes in a reel. So out of that one reel of thread, there are 12 sugas in that reel. So if we want it to be finer, we then split that thread down finer than that whole thread that it comes in. The Chinese silk comes in a very slightly twisted two strands of silk, and each one of that I call it as an 8 count thread, and each of the 8 count I can split it down to one or even finer than one,
Oh,
depending on what I'm.
so you'll even take that strand and split that then.
That's correct. So I can actually split it down to almost two, three filaments, which is almost invisible sometimes. But that's how we work. Especially with the art embroidery, we do need to be able to do that.
Well, yeah, and that's why I asked, because in the art embroidery, I mean, you're shading and your color changing nuances are so very delicate that I figured you had to be working with some very thin thread.
That's right. But it's not just the thread, it's actually the technique as well, because there are various different techniques that we can select from, and it is understanding the characteristic of the technique and say what is the best technique that I would wish to apply to get the visual result that I would like.
Standard needles, you have extra fine needles. You must have an array of needles for all of those techniques.
No. With the Japanese, yes. With the Japanese, we actually use handmade needles, which is has got a flat head and a round eye and very short and very, very sharp. Traditionally, they were made by samurai sword makers. And so we have different sizes of needles. But in art embroidery, we actually only use one type of needle. It's a very fine needle and not very long, very thin. And that will allow us to go through the fabric very smoothly.
Okay. Boy, there's an extreme samurai sword to embroidery needles.
That's right. That's right.
That's some talent for a sword maker right there. Can you make a needle and a sword in the same day? Yes.
But it's a very special needle.
And are those made out of steel, highly
Yeah.
polished?
No, not galvanized, but polished. Yes.
Yes, polished, yeah, I'm sure too. Very, very smooth, yes.
Like it's like brushed steel.
Okay. And I'm sure with you go through a ton of needles in a year with all the embroidery.
No, they're precious needles.
Oh.
I'm still with the original set that I started out with. I look after them well.
Oh my, the original set.
Yes, I clean them. I keep them in an environment that moisture does not get to them.
Wow.
So they're very precious.
That's like old friends there. Oh.
Right, that's right.
Oh.
And I think the way we hold our needle as well is a little bit different from Western embroidery. So we don't bend our needles. We hold our needle at the eye of the needle and then we push it down. So we don't hold the middle of the needle, so therefore it does not get bent.
Oh, I have to try that.
For me, it's quite interesting to see the transition of my students who are used to Western style embroidery working with the Asian needles.
Well, that to have a needle be that old and still be able to use it. I mean, I've actually worn out needles. Basically, they just break at the eye. But is it the steel that's used that makes them so durable? And then when you care for them, they last. I mean, I would think that the metal itself eventually would just wear right down.
Japanese one definitely no. They still maintain its sharpness because I think the way it's tempered steel, the way that they make it. So it's like the swords. So they do last a long time. The Chinese ones that I use, yes, they do get a little bit blunt and but if you use it properly, they don't get blunt that easily.
The things I learn. Your daughters pick up learn embroidery from you and continue it, or not interested?
Oh, I'm embarrassed to say not interested. Not a very good mother.
That's okay. Yeah, they just didn't just not part of their world, huh?
Part of their world. But who knows? I've got two granddaughters that I'm very hopeful.
Yeah. Well, I've said this many times that you learn those things at an early age, and you never know when they'll come back as you get through life and get a little older and have a little bit of time, and you never know when that might pop right back up. So,
That is true.
yeah.
I've also heard here that it skips a generation.
Ah. Okay, we're counting on the grandkids
That's right.
then. So, do you stitch a lot during the day, or are you pretty much consumed with your teaching?
Oh no, I do. I still do stitch a lot. You have to keep your hand in it. So every day.
Projects going all the time.
That's right. So if I'm teaching, I might work on smaller projects that I can bring away with me, and I might put in maybe an hour or so during the day. And I generally have take December and part of January and part of November off, and that is my stitching time.
That's the cherished time then. Yes.
That's right.
Do you find in your classes that you're getting young people, or is that a concern?
That is a general concern among the embroidery world, I think. time seems to be very lacking in the younger generation nowadays.
Yeah, it's too bad. Yep. Do you get some young people, or is are they pretty scarce?
I have, when I say young, younger than me, yes, I do, but not young as in teenagers. So I have a couple who, a few who are maybe in their 30s. So which, you know, is really good. It
Well, that's
means that there
young.
is.
That's young. I'll take that.
Yes. So yeah. So there's hope. There's hope.
Do you get many mails?
I have two.
All right.
And doing really well. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, us males are accused of being very precise stitchers. Do you find that?
Well, no. Yes and no. Precise in is what we want. We want precision. But I've also find that they can look outside the box and be a bit creative, which is also what we look for in art embroidery. I wish we have a few more males, you know, because it is quite refreshing sometimes to see their approach to it.
Oh, in what way?
I think in the way that they are more intense. The focus is a little bit more than the women, I suppose, because the women sometimes do approach it a little bit more like a social event. Whereas the men who do take it up tends to be very focused. And it is actually wonderful to be, you know, teaching someone who is very focused.
Yeah, you can make progress in a hurry. Yes.
Oh, they do. And that's it. When they're focused, you do find that they do progress very quickly.
Well, I'm just glad to hear there's at least a couple of males showing up. That's great.
Well, in Japanese embroidery, traditionally, it is the male profession. Whereas in Chinese art embroidery, it was actually the female. And when I say the female, it is done by the daughters of the elite that takes up art embroidery.
Margaret, this has been fun. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I've learned so much here. That's just a fascinating world to me because it's I admire the precision and the culture and the history and the dedication to very precise technique. I just admire all of that, and it's really great to learn some of that. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Not at all, Gary. Nice speaking to you.
All right. Thanks to everyone for listening.